Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Androshko versus Borgen. Mr. Nolan.
May it please the court. Morning, Your Honors. Brett Nolan on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Gary Androshko. This case comes before you on Mr. Androshko's petition for habeas corpus, filed pursuant to 28 U.S. Code, Section 2254. Mr. Androshko's original petition was denied by the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. A certificate of appealability was subsequently granted by this court on September 25, 2002. Mr. Androshko seeks a reversal of the District Court's denial of his petition for habeas corpus and a remand to the District Court for further proceedings. We are charged with demonstrating today that Mr. Androshko received ineffective assistance of counsel both at the sentencing phase of his trial as well as at the appellate level.
Mr. Nolan, wasn't all of the mitigating evidence that you fault Mr. Androshko's trial counsel for not presenting contained within the pre-sentence report?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, but with the caveat that it was presented in the pre-sentence report and commented on in a negative manner by the assistant district attorney.
But if it was all there, shouldn't we presume that the trial court considered that evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, but at the same time, had Mr. Androshko's counsel at sentencing made any effort at all in which to draw inferences from that evidence that would support any mitigation, to support a downward adjustment from 30 years to somewhere between the range of 20 to 30 years.
See, I think the problem is that Mr. Androshko committed a series of very serious crimes, and he doesn't dispute that he told the probation officer that he felt good when he did them. And so what basis would we have to believe that any trial court, you know, let alone this trial court, would have sentenced Mr. Androshko differently, even if his counsel had put on mitigating evidence?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Androshko does challenge the notion that he was, quote, a thrill-seeking criminal. That was one of the conclusions that arose from the PSI report and was unrebutted by his counsel at sentencing.
But does he dispute that he told the probation officer that he felt good when he did these crimes?
He does not dispute that, Your Honor.
And he said that something is missing in his life when he's not doing a crime. I mean, the problem is, as Judge Rowland has pointed out, the court knew the fact. The key facts that the court seemed to rely on are facts that were not in dispute. So how can you show prejudice?
Your Honor, respectfully, it's our position that had Mr. Androshko's trial counsel done anything at all to try to lessen the damage that was caused by the PSI report, if you look at the record that demonstrates the actual hearing, the sentencing hearing, Mr. Androshko's trial counsel did less than nothing, did not try to rebut or refute any of the inferences made by Assistant District Attorney Hart, and that's the reason why Mr. Androshko continues to assert his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Your Honors, because the state of Wisconsin focuses its attention primarily on the issue of procedural default, we will address that issue next. The state of Wisconsin contends that Mr. Androshko procedurally defaulted on his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel because he failed to raise this claim in his first post-conviction motion filed pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 974.06. We challenge that notion. First of all, the procedural default rule that should have been applied in this matter is the default rule enunciated in the Bergenthal v. State case rather than the Escalona-Naranjo case. The Bergenthal decision, which is more lenient, allows a defendant to raise constitutional claims in a subsequent collateral post-conviction motion. That is the rule that should have been applied given the timing of Mr. Andrashko's post-conviction motion. Secondly, the state law regarding procedural default in this matter, which is, as the state points out, Wisconsin Statute 974.064, that ban on successive collateral post-conviction motions, was not a firmly established and regularly followed rule by the Wisconsin courts at the time that Mr. Andrashko made his decision to file the claim that he did. Accordingly, that procedural default rule should not be applied to Mr. Andrashko, and so there should be no procedural default in this matter. However, even assuming, for the sake of today's argument, that Mr. Andrashko did procedurally default on his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, that does not end the analysis. That is because there is cause to excuse Mr. Andrashko's alleged default of the claim for ineffective assistance of counsel, and that is the ineffective assistance of counsel that he received on the appellate level. There are two reasons for this ineffective assistance of counsel at the appellate level. First of all, Mr. Andrashko's appellate counsel failed to file anything, be it a 974.06 motion or a 974.02 motion or a direct appeal until over 1 year after Mr. Andrashko's actual conviction. Secondly, there was no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel brought in Mr. Andrashko's initial post-conviction motion because, as the record shows, Mr. Andrashko's appellate counsel stated to Mr. Andrashko that any such claim for ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing was waived by his guilty plea. In effect, Mr. Andrashko's appellate counsel repeated the rule that a guilty plea waived all non-jurisdictional defects. Well, that advice, that counsel was ineffective because that rule should not apply to Mr. Andrashko's claim for ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing. Were Mr. Andrashko's appellate counsel's advice to be taken as true, you would have the result of defendants who plead guilty are then subject to ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing. Then they would be foreclosed from asserting any sort of claim that they received ineffective assistance of counsel, not at the trial phase or not at the plea bargain phase, but at the sentencing phase. And that it is at that junction of the proceedings, the sentencing phase, that Mr. Andrashko relies on for his ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Of course.
Yes.
The judge said, you've gotten an extraordinary deal here. You're a fellow that could have gotten 171 years. It's an uphill battle, isn't it?
Your Honor, we don't challenge the fact that Mr. Andrashko could have received 171 years. The fact is, Mr. Andrashko's counsel at sentencing, having reached the plea bargain negotiation with the assistant district attorney, that in exchange for a plea of no contest, a plea of guilty, he would receive a sentence, she would recommend a sentence between 20 and 30 years. Having reached that bargain, having made that bargain, that didn't end Mr. Andrashko's appellate counsel's duty to continue to render effective assistance of counsel. And that means at the sentencing phase, he couldn't sit on his hands. He had to try to do something in order to ratchet the sentence, the possible sentence, from a range of, at the high end, 30, down to 20. Finally, I'd like to conclude the remarks by pointing out that the preparation and performance at the sentencing hearing by Mr. Andrashko's trial counsel at sentencing fell below any objective standard of reasonableness, and that performance, that deficient performance, then resulted in prejudice to Mr. Andrashko pursuant to the two-pronged Strickland test. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Ms. Moore?
Good morning. Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller appearing on behalf of the respondent, Borgen. This court issued a certificate of appealability encompassing two issues. Whether Andrashko received the ineffective assistance of counsel at his sentencing, and whether his procedural default of this issue in state court is excused by appellate counsel's ineffectiveness.
Ms. Moeller, let me ask you this. I mean, I assume that Wisconsin has the ability to appeal in the state court the sentence itself rather than the conviction.
No, that is not correct. Unless the sentence was absolutely illegal. The state does not have the ability to say that the imposition of sentence was an abuse of discretion, for example.
Then why are we here on the question of the incompetence of counsel if you can't appeal it in the state court? Sentence, that is.
And I'm not sure I'm gathering what you're asking, because it's Mr. Andrasko's contention that he received ineffective assistance.
Well, I'm asking you the question of why just your argument might not be to us that you can't appeal a sentence in the state.
I misunderstood your question. I thought you were asking if the state could take an appeal from a sentence. Yes, you can appeal a sentence as being an abuse of discretion, as being an imposition of an illegal sentence, whatever, that it was based on improper factors.
Similar
there are a variety of reasons.
Similar to the now federal system where you can appeal a sentence as opposed to not even contest a conviction, but just the sentence itself.
That's correct. There's a Wisconsin statute that says that the only issue you want to raise on appeal is the imposition of sentence. I think it's with stat 973.19. You take an appeal solely on that basis, you can do so.
Did Mr. Andrashko ever raise in state court the particular ineffectiveness argument that he is making now in federal court? In other words, that his counsel failed to present mitigating evidence at sentencing and failed to rebut the prosecutor's argument about his violent nature?
I believe that he raised that issue. I'm not sure if it was with this degree of detail, but he raised that issue in his fourth 974-06 motion.
I can't find it. Where in the record did he raise his that particular ineffective assistance claim that he's arguing now in his brief before us?
My understanding was that in his fourth post-conviction motion, that's when he first attempted to raise it, and I don't recall whether a copy of the motion is included in any of the exhibits to the response. But I don't think this court needs to worry about whether he even raised it with that detail in his fourth motion, because I think it's clear he cannot show cause to excuse his procedural default here.
Well, see, if not, then your argument about successive section 974.06 motions would be beside the point. That's the point I'm trying to make here.
That's correct. If he has never, ever raised it in any of his 974-06 motions, then it would make no difference because he hadn't brought it up in state court. But my understanding, and it's been a while since I've gone through all of the exhibits, was that the first time this was raised and pursued was in his fourth motion filed in 1994. I know he raised and then abandoned the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing in his second 974-06 motion.
It seems to me that what he did was he asserted only that counsel was ineffective during trial, that counsel should have requested a psychiatric examination prior to sentence, and that he was incompetent to be sentenced. But he never presented the claim that trial counsel was ineffective at sentencing to the state court. So he couldn't have procedurally defaulted it the way, the state has been arguing.
Well, I'm convinced that he did raise it initially in his second 974-06 motion, that the trial court, for whatever reason, this was the one filed not with attorney Casey, but he did it by himself in 1992, that particular motion claimed counsel was ineffective at sentencing, and for whatever reason, the state circuit court never addressed it, never addressed the motion at all. And then counsel was appointed in 1993, and at that point, the claim was abandoned. And then I believe the record shows, and I can't give you the citation to the exhibit, that in the fourth motion, that was when he first claimed it. But to address the second issue briefly, if you were to reach the merits of the claim of ineffective assistance at sentencing, I think there's one thing I need to correct that appears in the appellant's reply brief, and that is the statement is made that once the plea bargain was struck, that the only sentence that could be imposed was between 20 and 30 years. That is not correct. Even after the plea bargain, in which Mr. Andrashko pled no contest to six felonies, the trial court was free to reject the recommendation of the prosecutor. In Wisconsin, the trial court is not bound whatsoever by the prosecutor's plea agreement, and so the judge was still allowed to sentence Andrashko to up to 171 years. By striking the plea bargain in the first place, he reduced his exposure from over 240-some years down to 171 by virtue of various charges that were dismissed. So he really got a sweet deal. And not only did he only get 30 years, which was the recommendation of the PSI and which was within the parameters of what the prosecutor agreed to recommend, the trial judge gave him a further deal by making that 30-year sentence concurrent and not consecutive to any term he was already serving on prior offenses. So in this case, sentencing was somewhat anticlimactic because he got such a dramatic decrease in his, not only his exposure, but in also what he could have received had the trial court decided to ignore the prosecutor's recommendation.
On a 30-year sentence in the state of Wisconsin, what will he realistically serve?
I checked that before I actually came here, and he's up for parole again in August of 2004. His mandatory release date, I think, is something like 2017. I don't think I can give a hard and fast answer because we've changed our sentencing so much. Initially, at the time he was sentenced, you were eligible after you'd only done a quarter, which would have been 7.5 years.
Right.
But now we have truth in sentencing so that you, you know, serve the entire amount. He falls under the old law. But he's definitely, you know, eligible for parole right now. So in summary, the state is asking this court, first of all, to find that the procedural default of this issue, ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing, cannot be excused by ineffective assistance of appellate counsel because there never was a direct appeal. And whether or not Attorney Casey performed ineffectively in the context of a 974-06 proceeding, Mr. Andrashko had no right to counsel in that proceeding under Pennsylvania versus Finley, and therefore under Coleman versus Thompson, any ineffectiveness of counsel at that proceeding cannot constitute cause for a procedural default. Alternatively, if this court were to reach the merits, there is not a reasonable possibility that Mr. Andrashko would have received any less than the 30-year sentence he got had counsel performed any differently at the sentencing hearing. If there are no further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nolan, you have 1 minute.
Please, the court. I'd like to focus my final moments on a discussion of Mr. Andrashko's sentencing counsel's performance. Between Mr. Andrashko's arraignment and the actual sentencing hearing, Mr. Andrashko's sentencing counsel met with Mr. Andrashko one time. In addition, sentencing counsel reviewed the PSI report, which is a very important document to the judge in terms of sentencing. He reviewed that PSI report for 12 minutes. In addition, Mr. Andrashko's sentencing counsel completely failed at all to investigate any evidence of mitigation that he could present to the sentencing judge. As a result, we find it's our position, Your Honors, that Mr. Andrashko's sentencing counsel's performance was deficient, and that deficiency resulted in prejudice to Mr. Andrashko. Accordingly, we would ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court and to grant Mr. Andrashko's petition for habeas corpus.
Mr. Nolan, you were appointed to represent your defendant in this case. You have the thanks of the court for accepting the appointment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your representation. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.